So I'm going to talk a little bit about the HIPAA final rule. Some of you might have run across this in your daily practice. You might be running a little bit more into this as we move on down the road into how we collect health information, how we use it, what does big data mean to public health practitioners. So I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. So just to start out a little bit, like I'm going to try to tie in what I'm going to say with what other people are going to present. So I'm going to focus on the big data aspects of how HIPAA interacts with public health data and public health research. So what is big data? It can be described by how technology maximizes the power that lies within big data. Big data itself actually is actually described the way we use analytics to help us make sense of data that's contained within what we call big data sets. And because of the power we believe big data contains, we might be able to say that it contains a greater truth than, let's say, compared to smaller data sets. So there's some basic approaches we could take to using big data in public health research. Obviously, the utilitarian sort of cost-benefit as we're drilling down into data sets, you know, we're balancing the individual cost against the social benefit that we might get out of using a large data set. The fairness or justice approach, you know, if we're going to use big data in public health research, we want to treat everybody equally, but if we're not going to, we must make some sort of defensible reason why we're not treating everybody equally when we use data and figure out outcomes from data. We could take a common good approach. You know, using as social scientists, we think about all these interlocking relationships in public health and the health outcomes, and we especially want to use big data to help those that are most vulnerable. We'd also take a virtue approach. What is the best approach? Maybe not necessarily the most efficient or the most cost-effective, but what's the best approach we can use when we're using large data sets to figure out, you know, and solve some public health issues? I think maybe these two might be the best two frameworks to take when we're using large data sets for public health research. So a rights-based approach, using humans as the ends, not the means to an ends. This might be difficult when we're using large data sets because humans are actually the ones contributing the data to the data set. So it's this strange sort of, we have to strike a balance between, we're not going to use humans as the mechanics to reach an end, but we must use the data contained there to improve the lives of humans. And I actually think consequentialism might be the best framework to use, that we use big data to produce the greatest social outcome. However, again, balancing this private interest, private privacy, individual privacy against the greater social good. So here's the rule, the final rule on HIPAA. Limited data sets can be disclosed from health entities. You must have a data use agreement in place. You can use them for research purposes. Obviously, you need a research protocol for IOB approval if you're going to subsequently use the data for publishing manuscripts. Also, we have this necessary for research purposes, so also the minimum necessary. We can't share more data than whatever research question we're asking. We only need to have the data that we need there. There are also some more narrow, more narrow scope for waivers. But this is the main one, I think, for public health researchers. When you're working with a health entity and trying to get data, working with them and getting their data. So the final rule says the only remuneration received by the entity or a business associate is a reasonable cost-based fee to cover the cost to prepare and transmit. Now, HHS hasn't described what reasonable means. Is it geographic-based? Is it based on the size of the data set you might be using? You know, is it based on how complex the data might be? We don't know. That's really to be determined. There's also something else to note here, that as public health researchers, you can also approach entities if you want to ask some research questions in the healthcare operations label under the final rule. However, under the operations label, that doesn't require necessarily IRB approval, but the outcomes aren't publishable because you haven't set out a research protocol and you haven't given individuals the protection they need. So Some researchers might approach this because the data sharing is more fluid. However, the outcomes aren't necessarily more favorable for publishable or generalizable research. So in practice, as we all know, HIPAA really sort of stops there. There isn't much beyond, there aren't many individual protections beyond that. You know, so there aren't, I'm making the claim that there aren't adequate legal safeguards for big data. Mainly because, like I said, big data is sort of defined by this this analytic way that we approach it, and I think the analytics are the most vulnerable. That's the most vulnerable piece of big data. So, but analytics are what we use to make sense of big data. So it's this sort of quandary. Big data is defined by analytics, yet analytics are what make it most vulnerable. I think the next question we have to ask is, how are analytics being discovered? Who's paying for the way analytics are discovered? I think this is really important when we look at research that might be published from using large data sets. Who is paid for the analytics? I would analogize this to drug discovery. It could take years to develop a meaningful analytic to use on big data, so that means lots of dollars have gone into that. And I think we should take a step back and ask ourselves, you know, who is spending the money, what questions do they mean to ask of the data, and what outcomes are they really seeking from the data? This leads us to, I'm sorry.
Sorry, could you define the terms here? So in analytics, is that a formula? Is it a result of the formula?
Analytics, I would say, is the algorithm used to combine or make sense of different items contained within a data set. So it could be demographic data, it could be geographic data, it could be any item contained within that data set. It's the analytic used to bring all those things together and actually make sense of it.
But it's not the data, it's the algorithm.
It's the algorithm used to make sense of the data. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So obviously this means that there's big bias in big data. So like I said, who's paying for it? What are the outcomes? As an example here, and I found this example from the Children's Hospital here in Boston, they determined that they could figure out down to the neighborhood based on Facebook likes, the rates of obesity in different neighborhoods around Boston. Now Facebook likes aren't governed by HIPAA. You know, this is just random information that they've aggregated together, but yet they're claiming that there are some public health outcomes here to be observed, and yet HIPAA has it doesn't govern this at all. Is there meaningful output here if we can aggregate sort of data that's not governed by HIPAA? And if we're using health data, how do we aggregate data with health data, having part of it governed by HIPAA and part of it not governed by HIPAA? Also something, we also have to include computer scientists in this analytics discovery. Businesses use this all the time, and I'm going to give an example about the way Target has done this. Some of you might know about this. So it's when we have large data sets, we want to use predictive analytics. You know, we want to make the most meaningful use of the data we have in front of us. Yet we can't predict on the front end what we might find out on the back end. And I think HIPAA sort of sets out to say we're trying to protect on the front end, but in reality we can't protect what comes out on the other end. So here's the Target example. So PHI, protected health information, or individual identifiable information, isn't always a direct consequence of a human interacting with an information system or another human being putting information into an information system. And some of you are shaking your heads about this case with Target. I think that it was a teenage girl. She went shopping at Target. I think she bought some lotion, a baby blanket, maybe a purse that was big enough to double as a diaper bag. And then she gets home, and her parents are receiving these mailers and these advertisements for a woman who would be pregnant. But yet she hadn't announced to anyone, her family or anyone, that she was pregnant. And her parents were sort of outraged, and they approached Target about it. And Target was sort of like, well, analytics, that's our business. We do what we do. It's all private information. We're gonna try to tailor our advertisements a little better. So I think what the approach they've taken is that they're still doing this, and they're still tracking their customers by customer ID, but yet they're mixing in other random items with that targeted with that targeted advertisement. So they might think a woman is pregnant, so they'll advertise to her, you know, baby blankets, strollers, whatever. But then they'll include things like lawn furniture or clocks or lamps or something, you know, to make it sort of look random, but it's not really that random. Again, with the Target example, so there's no private right enforcement action that you can take against an entity. It has to be, you know, entities have to self-report if there's some breach in data. So we rely on this self-reporting mechanism. You know, if it's high risk, we must report. If it's really high risk, then they go on the wall of shame. You know, there's a public way of reporting this. But this risk mechanism doesn't necessarily allow individuals to say, like this pregnant girl, to say, hey, you're really invading my privacy, yet the information Target was collecting, HIPAA didn't have anything to do with that. The Obama administration has sort of laid out this Consumer Bill of Rights. I think it's aspirational at this point, I would call it. So we're saying we want individual control in the data that's input into large databases or big data, and we want transparency in the data. Now, going back to the analytics question, again, in the outputs that we can't necessarily predict, how can we really say there is transparency in big data? We can't really say that. Respect for context, I think the context thing is the key here. When we think about individual privacy concerns balanced with the social good, we always want to, as public health researchers, we always want to provide more context. The crazy thing is, I think if we use health data, protected health information that is governed by HIPAA, I think actually the outside data, Facebook likes, Twitter feeds, those things can actually add context to protected health information. And yet we have to be sure that we're still protecting individual privacy with that information. Although there isn't a legal safeguard against it, we should be concerned with the ethical safeguards when we're using that type of data. So I also thought, why might we want to limit the control people have over their PHI? Might we not? If in the Consumer Bill of Rights, individual control over the type of data that's inputted in there, going to the sort of informed consent, can people sort of check boxes about what they want tracked? Can it be an opt-in or opt-out? I don't want you to say this about my health. I want you to say this about my health. Can people say, I only want you to report it in this kind of way? You know, so these are just some things to think about when we aggregate things into big data sets and use health data combined with other types of data out there. And balancing the public health with human rights, like I said, there are ethical parameters that I think we should be concerned with and that are non-legal. Data use agreements might help, but again, going back to this predictive analytics, we can't necessarily say what the outcome is going to be. So we might be able to write some data use agreements that could help us, sort of an umbrella clause maybe in those that might help protect us. But again, we don't know. Again, going back to the contextual analysis, adding context to any outcomes you might see when you're drilling down into big data, I think is the key here. We obviously want to maximize beneficence, not only to the individual but to the population. Especially if the individual has contributed to the data set you're using to target a population. You know, we want to sort of this cyclical, we want individuals to contribute because we need their information, but yet we still need to give back to that individual's population to improve their health. We also must admit what we didn't find. I think researchers take a positive approach largely. I found this quote from a Nobel laureate. The positives have a simple solution. The world must be divided into that which we can say clearly and the rest, which we had better pass over in silence. But can anyone conceive of a more pointless philosophy, seeing that what we can say clearly amounts to next to nothing? I think this rings true very much for big data. We don't necessarily know what's contained in there. We're doing our best to develop comprehensive analytics, but I think I saw a figure in the last 5 years we've created 80% of the data that's been created in our history, in human history, and it's just increasing exponentially. But if we omitted all that is unclear, we would probably be left with completely uninteresting and trivial tautologies. I think that's very true. So tools and approaches for the future. We must admit the weaknesses that we have in our analytics, the weaknesses and the missing pieces within that are in big data. We need to ask ourselves the why and the how. Why are we collecting it? How are we collecting it? Who's paying for us to collect it? What might be their motivations and objectives? I think we could also learn some lessons from small data collections. That's what most of us are most familiar with. Most people think of big data being raw data, so we might be able to use some qualitative methods in elucidating the erraticness of some of the information contained within big data. I think as social scientists, we might want to make big data that is complex maybe even more complex. So we have to remain conscious of this context and who's contributing to the data set, how are we using it, how are we returning the good to them. And we must be intentional in our ethical inquiry when we're going through every phase of the process, developing the analytics, using the analytics, what have we seen from the big data and how can it be used. And I think in the age of millennials, myself included in that, and the government is sort of moving into this, we need to share all of our data with each other. We need to sort of break down the barriers between keeping data behind closed doors or behind a firewall or whatever it might be, and share that data with each other. And I think this idea of complete data sharing is going to make these questions around protected health information even more complex as we move into the future. So, questions? Yes.
So, good talk, thank you. So, three things. One is for you to comment on. You mentioned earlier that humans contribute to big data, but not voluntarily, right? It is in fact a requirement for life that we do this. Not only do we do it involuntarily, we do it without our knowledge. Let me just mention two things that from information ethics. That might actually be helpful. So people in information ethics are all very worried about this and believe, and one of the moves is to try to make more transparent and candid exactly how pervasive the scary reach of big data analytics are. So there's been lots of prevarication and lying recently with respect to, you know, things like NSA collection of metadata. So, and just people have been lying. Anyway, sorry, I guess that's not a technical term. But to get sort of clear about what that is. But my last thing is, and this is maybe for you to comment on, from the information ethics, there have been some talks and moves called digital forgetting, the destruction of data after a certain period of time, and sort of having data have a sell-by date. So Ed Markey, senator from Massachusetts, has been trying to get some legislation passed with respect to children. So this helps with, you know, sort of everything from bullying information to other kinds of things. So maybe it's antithetical to researchers that you want to get rid of data, but maybe this might be an approach to getting a little more control over it.
It might be an approach. The thing that comes to mind to me is, you know, once we post something online, voluntarily or involuntarily, we don't know how many copies of that has been made. You know, I think it might be difficult to trace the steps.
It actually has a system now in place where people can, in fact, appeal. There's an office that they can appeal to get certain data erased. And Spain has actually kind of been in the forefront of this. So European Union is already kind of.
Well, it sounds like our government would have to come together and have some, you know, federal system, federal tracking system, so that we could drill down and be sure we got it. We got every piece now. That's going to happen. I don't know. I think the EU is probably better at that than the states would ever be. Yeah.
All of the EU provisions to their privacy laws. And I mean, I got that rule redone 15 times. But what's being stated about the Bill of Rights here isn't directly in conflict with what we're actually doing in the State Department. We're trying to arm wrestle Europe. Their context, we're context dependent. I think that was the one person mentioned. Everything we're doing here is context dependent. Once you're out of that context, the target example is great.
Yeah.
But this is kind of like playing whack.
I agree. Thank you for the comment. Thank you.
I just have sort of a question of where you see. I'm a primary care provider in Montana and a rural site, and we're an FPCHD. So we have meaningful use criteria that we have to abide by, and I'm also engaged in making research. So I'm sort of at that nexus of an interesting place where we have criteria and we have to collect big data to get funding. And obviously, our patients don't know that all the time. Our providers don't even always know it. You know, we're asking tobacco questions, we're asking obesity stuff. It's going to directly correlate to certain programs that we put them in or push for that, which is an ethical consideration. And then we have a bill that was passed effective October 1st that says we can no longer, and it's not that you can look it up, but ask about whether you have a firearm in your house in the state of Montana. And the reaction against this, the data collection, the implications about what it can do socially. So my question is more, that's framing the question of where do you see this sort of nexus of educating to obtain data at a massive level, because certainly community health centers and meaningful use and all that is part of that metadata and that collection process, educating, obtaining that data, informing the patient, and then sort of that criteria, because it's legislated at a certain level, but you know, it's just sort of, it just doesn't seem like there's anything coming together to sort of reify, educate, legislate. They're all feeling so desperate. That moment, that just seems like a moment where everything comes together and no one is informed at that
moment. Yeah, I think going back to the Bill of Rights, I think maybe you're talking maybe to transparency a little bit, informing.
Transparency, accurate data collection, efficacy.
I also, the accuracy piece is somewhat troublesome. Like you said, if you work in primary care, you know, how many people contribute to a patient's record, right? How many different pieces of information, and what formatting are they using? Like I said, with the qualitative, are they entering text about the individual? So I think educating the patient goes so far. I also think maybe to some patients, I work with a group of anesthesiologists. Patients don't really understand how, you know, nebulous big data actually is. You know, they might see big data as a way of healthcare rationing. Some people might, you know, patients might be concerned about that. But I think mainly to reach that point and have everyone agree, maybe it's educating the users of that data. But I don't. You have a good question. I don't know how to frame that meeting point between the where that data is being input and who's using it. I don't know. It's a good question though. Yeah.
Another definitional question again. So is there a heuristic by which the industry uses to differentiate big data from, as you put it, small data? And then two, I was also interested in follow up to this gentleman's point. You know, is there another body, whether it be EHA or otherwise, who are offering a separate set of quote-unquote rights as it relates to big data?
The heuristic? I would say maybe small data we might call primarily collected data. That's why it might be small. We're going out and intentionally collecting it. We're informing the individuals. I think with big data, it's all these little pieces of information coming together. I'm not sure there's a necessarily. I don't know where if you draw the line between when small data then becomes big data. Is that
so
your question?
Big data doesn't refer to the size of the data set as opposed to the
analytics that are used on it.
Longitudinality. I mean, that is secondary data.
It could also be cross-sectional, I think. It doesn't necessarily have to be longitudinal. It could be, like I said, big data is defined by the analytics you use, but I think the analytics piece is we must develop high-level analytics to make sense of it. I think that's where the difference is. And with small data, we don't necessarily need years and years of development, I mean, in analytics to make sense of small data.